From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's day 33 of the partial government shutdown, and federal workers will get a second payless paycheck this Friday if nothing is done to end that impasse over President Trump's demand for a $5.7 billion border wall and the Democrats' demand for border security they say would work better.
Let's bring in our political strategist, Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Hi, Alice. Alice, you there?
I am here.
I hear you now. Okay. Bill Press also with us, Democrat who hosts the Bill Press radio show in Washington. Hi, Bill.
Hey, I'm here too.
Okay.
Hi.
Good. We haven't shut down the analysts today, but Bill, is a way out emerging? We're hearing today that House Democrats are willing to offer up substantial sums of more money for border security, although it sounds like no wall.
I hope a way is out. I think it's unconscionable to require people to come to work and not get paid, or to stay home and not get paid. And I think the way out is a way that the Senate voted for, and this is what I hope they end up doing this week, that the Senate voted for in late December and the House has voted for several times since, which is reopen the government, separate the two. They should not be connected. Reopen the government and then negotiate, debate, talk about what we're going to do about border security. That's something that both Republicans and Democrats in the Senate have suggested. And I think they may be moving in that direction.
But not including President Trump, Alice.
Not yet. Right.
The president will not open the government and then begin having these conversations because he doesn't trust that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and Democrats will follow through on serious negotiations with regard to this wall. And look, Democrats were in favor of a secure fence back in 2006. There's no difference in a similar type of structure now that they had supported back then. The only difference is that this is something that President Trump is pushing and advocating for.
Alice, I just want to ask, is that really true? I really want to get to the heart of this. And we right. are talking to people on the border and people expert in these issues. And many of them are saying that's really not the issue. There's an understanding that's grown that the wall does work in some places on the border, and it absolutely doesn't in others. And there were much better ways to do it. Isn't that a legitimate argument?
It absolutely is, and you're spot on with that, Robin. And the president, as we saw him speak over the weekend, he addressed that. He said, look, we don't need a wall the entire length of the border. And he specifically said we are also allocating money for technology for drug detection. We're allocating funds for more judges, which is also part of border security process, and also money for humanitarian needs. So he is acknowledging that the wall from sea to shining sea is no longer what we need. He has evolved on this issue, and he has made it clear we can use boots on the ground, drones in the air, and other forms of border security. But for some reason, Democrats are just hell-bent on no because there's any talk of a wall.
No, I know it's very catchy to try to blame this all on Democrats. This is Donald Trump's shutdown. It's Donald Trump's wall.
To that question of the wall itself. Go ahead.
No, I just want to say, first of all, I have to say, if you put together everything Donald Trump has said about what kind of a wall this is going to be, how long it's going to be, how big it's going to be, what it's going to be made of, you could fill a whole encyclopedia. So you just have to almost ignore what he says. The wall will not work. Let's look at the Chapo trial in New York. I think it's very instructive. Chapo, the biggest drug dealer of all time, has told about how he got the drugs in the country. They didn't come across the fence. They came through the ports of entry, or they came through tunnels, which could be built under any wall. I think that trial kind of refutes everything that Donald Trump says about the need for the wall. And I think, to Alice's point, Democrats have put forth six bills in the House so far that will put a lot of money up for border security. They're willing to negotiate border security. Again, Donald Trump just wants his campaign promise, his wall, and he's dug in his heels.
And he wants to deliver the State of the Union address in the House of Representatives. Let's talk about that. He sent a letter to Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying that there are no shutdown-related security concerns that will prevent him from delivering his State of the Union address next week in the House. So he plans to deliver the speech there. Of course, she would have to invite him to the House in order to do that. She had asked him to postpone it. Here is the White House spokesperson Sarah Sanders on Fox and Friends today.
The president will talk to the American people on January 29th,
one way or
as
another.
He does nearly every single day. And we're going to continue moving forward with the State of the Union, and we'll see what happens.
Alice, who's going to win this fight? And does it matter? Because there is nothing in the Constitution that says the president has to deliver the State of the Union in the House of Representatives in person. He just has to tell them what the State of the Union is in some way.
It used to be a letter. Yeah.
Exactly. If I was a betting woman, which I'm not, I would put my money on Donald Trump winning this, because he will find a way to get this out there and communicate it in a very presidential way. It does not have to be on the House floor. But here's the irony here. Nancy Pelosi rescinded her invitation for speaking on the House floor due to the shutdown, but she offered the invitation during a shutdown. So she's kind of talking out of both sides of her mouth. But at the end of the day, those people that aren't getting paid and potentially seeing another payless paycheck, as you said, Robin, they could care less when and where this happens. And I wish that both sides, Republicans and Democrats, would spend more time on ending the partial shutdown and less time bickering about a turf war about over the State of the Union.
Bill, I just have to add, I think it would be wholly inappropriate to have a State of the Union in the House of Representatives and go through that pageantry and that tra-la-la, which is so phony anyhow, when 800,000 federal employees are sitting home without getting a paycheck. And I think there'll be some kind of a message in writing, or maybe he'll give it outside of the Capitol or in another state. I doubt that it will be in the House of Representatives.
Bill, just a thought. I mean, I hear you on that, the idea of making the speech, not just when there's symbolically so many people out of work, but realistically, you know, Nancy Pelosi and others are saying that there are some security issues. It takes hundreds of people to secure this precious building because of the people that are going to be in it. I hear that. But doesn't it seem kind of small of the Democrats to not address it in another way, to not take the high road and say, how are we going to do this, Mr. President? You know, we want you to give the speech to the nation, as every president has. Doesn't it seem a little bit small? People don't believe that it's because of security. They don't believe
I hear you. I think it's very small. It's not small that 800,000 employees and their families are really hurting. I mean, people have to realize that. The economy is hurting. To ignore it and pretend that everything goes on as business as usual, I think would be unfair and, again, highly inappropriate.
Let's talk about the people who want to give the State of the Union in the future in a few years. Let's get to 2020 just in the few minutes we have left here. This morning, the 37-year-old openly gay mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, announced a long-shot bid for the Democratic presidential nomination, calling for a new generation of leadership. Here he is.
The show in Washington right now is exhausting. The corruption, the fighting, the lying, the crisis, it's got to end.
And on Monday, California Senator Kamala Harris entered the race, announcing her White House bid. Bill, what do you make of the latest developments on the Democratic side so far?
Well, come on in. The water's fine. You know?
There'll probably be 20 at least by the end of it.
I think so. My last count was 32. I think it's very exciting. And I think we're starting to see some serious candidates and some maybe not so serious. Pete Buttigieg, I know him. He's a good guy. He's, I think, a new generation of Democratic leadership. A really long shot, I think, for him. On the other hand, Kamala Harris has gotten a lot of excitement. She's a former prosecutor, former attorney general. I think a very serious candidate, raised a lot of money. And she come in her first 24 hours, comes from California, which has a lot of delegates, last time I checked, as former Democratic chair of California. So I think, you know what, again, we've got, what, 8 in so far? And they're probably going to be at least a dozen more.
I agree 100% with Bill in terms of come on in, the water's fine. This is an important – every presidential election isn't important, but this is extremely important. And it's helpful to the process to have candidates representing all views, all political ideologies, all backgrounds. And look, a lot of these names have – very low name ID, but Mike Huckabee had low name ID in 2007, and we won the Iowa caucus. So this is a smart for them to get in early, make the formal announcement, generate some earned media, get out there and connect with the people, not just in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, but across the country, and listen to them. I think this is good. It ultimately is great for America that the Democrats will find someone that they believe can take on Donald Trump. But the reality, no matter who it is, Donald Trump will be a formidable candidate in 2020.
Sure. I want to make it clear, I am not running.
So what? 31.
That's
okay,
not
31.
What, that's not
31.
What everybody. No. Hey, I just want to ask real
famous
quick.
Last words.
There is a book coming out. We only have a half a minute here. The latest White House tell-all, Team of Vipers, by former communications aide Cliff Sims, who had a very close relationship with Trump, was an ally, but is describing an unbelievably dysfunctional White House, according to the Washington Post, who got a hold of the book. Alice, are you bracing?
Look, this is going to be more of the same of out-of-control business at the White House. Cliff is a fantastic person. I've worked closely with him on campaigns. He's a solid conservative, a loyal soldier. But at the end of the day, he realized that he's totally dispensable in this White House.
Alice Stewart, the Republican, Bill Press, the Democrat. Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
The Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and the Mother Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, have a horrible bond. You probably know what it is. Both lost congregants to deadly shootings driven by hate. In October, 11 people died in the Tree of Life when a virulently anti-Semitic shooter opened fire during services. In 2015, a young white man was invited in to join the black parishioners at a Bible study at Mother Emmanuel AME. He turned out to be a hate-filled white supremacist who gunned down 9, including the pastor. Well, this past weekend, Jewish members of the New Light Congregation, one of 3 congregations at the Tree of Life Synagogue, they lost 3 parishioners in the shooting, visited the Mother Emmanuel Church to worship, to walk in the Martin Luther King Day parade, to get a group hug, and it sounds like to weep. Steve Cohen is co-president of the New Light Congregation. He's back in Pittsburgh. Hi, Steve.
And how are you today?
Just fine. And the Reverend Eric Manning is now pastor of the Mother Emmanuel AME Church. He's in Charleston. Reverend, welcome to you as well.
Hello to you, Robin.
Yeah. And I want to start with you. We know, Reverend, you flew to Pittsburgh after the shooting there last fall. You know, you joined this terrible flock of people from shooting scenes who do fly to other shootings to see if they can help. But in this case, this was a house of worship. How compelled were you to go?
Well, immediately after the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue, I spoke with my wife and had a moment of prayer and reflection. And shortly thereafter, I determined that the best thing for me to do was to travel to Pittsburgh just to be there and show solidarity and a ministry of presence, wanting them to know that they have someone, a congregation who understands their pain.
I was actually in the audience, and he was greeted graciously and warmly, and his presence was greatly appreciated.
Well, and then, Steve, we know the trip back to Charleston with your congregants was organized by the widow of Richard Gottfried. He was the beloved dentist who was killed in the Tree of Life. His widow went this past weekend. So did Gottfried's 2 sisters, we're reading in the Pittsburgh Post-Courier. One was his twin. The other, Carol Black, we understand, hid in a closet when he was killed. I can't imagine this wasn't traumatic to think of going to another scene of shooting.
Traumatic, I would not use the word traumatic. I would say uplifting and emotional. Hmm. It's now roughly 2 months, 2.5 months since the tragedy. And grieving takes a long time. And I think after the first several weeks, Peg felt a need to reach out and be with others who had been in a similar situation. The idea grew, and it resulted in 10 individuals from our congregation. And we have a relationship with the Rodman Street Baptist Church. Several of their members also joined us.
Well, Reverend Manning, so now the very bruised, raw congregants from Pittsburgh are coming to you. But we understand Your congregation is also very raw. And what we don't hear as much about is, you know, yes, there was the horrific attack in 2015, but there have been other threats on your church. There was a threat that there be an attack against a local mosque unless the convicted shooter, Dylan Roof from Charleston, was released. There were anonymous letters of general threats. This is nowhere near over for your congregation either.
No, it's not. As we were sharing with the New Light congregation Monday, it's the fact that by both of these attacks being driven by hate, it means that we have to continue to have a heightened sense of awareness and a heightened sense of alert.
Steve, we know Friday night you had a Jewish service, same on Saturday. And then we come to the services, two of them at AME on Sunday. Reverend Manning, this was your home court. What did you want to say or do in that service?
It was one to, of course, remember the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, but then most importantly as well to provide comfort and healing and strength to the New Light congregation members who were coming to worship with us. And I did share with them that it was a service where I'm not traditionally nervous, but I was a little apprehensive because I wanted the service to accomplish so much. And I pray that it did. And then even at the tail end of the service, we asked them to come and to the chancel rail, and the members of Mother Emmanuel gathered around them, and we began to pray with them and for them. And I wanted them to take a visual representation away that we are with them, that we are there for them and will continue to be there for them.
The pastor's sermon was very, very powerful. And for me, it hit home because one of his themes was that words matter. Hate speech is the underlying issue that caused our tragedy in Pittsburgh. And the ability to hear that from a different perspective was very comforting. And I will have to say that the at the end of the service, when the pastor called us up front, we were, at least I was not anticipating what he asked to do next. I started crying. The warmth, the love from the congregants was just overwhelming. What we're going through, what the members of the AME church went through, is just something that's unique. People don't, this doesn't happen every day.
It shouldn't happen. As I think somebody from a temple in Charleston said, you know, praying in a house of worship should not be an act of bravery.
But in today's world, the necessity for security is paramount. The Tree of Life Synagogue, the building that we live in, had been talking about beefing up its security, but at the time, it's a Shabbos. Your doors are open for worshipers to come in. The last thing any of us expected was that a gunman would enter in and destroy that which is most sacred.
Just talk a little more about that moment at the altar coming up. And, you know, everyone who's gone into a different house of worship from their own, there's a little bit of nervousness anyway. You know, what am I supposed to do? What if I touch the wrong thing or do the wrong thing or stand up, sit down? What am I supposed to do? And then here you are in this, the pictures are incredible, this cloud of an embrace.
It's funny. I do not go to church that often. But I have been since the tragedy. We were invited to the Rodman Street Baptist Church. So the services, per se, are not foreign.
Well, and then that hug.
The hug was incredible.
Yeah.
The hug was just incredible.
Yeah. Reverend, I want to ask about the survivors. Start with you. Horribly, there were very few survivors of the Bible study shooting. But one was Polly Shepherd. And we know that she actually traveled to Pittsburgh and spoke to some of the congregants of Tree of Life. Tell us about that.
She shared the importance of forgiveness and the importance of not allowing the hatred to weigh you down. And the words that, Polly shared, and as I always tell her, she's a rock. She encourages people. She has a huge, wonderful ministry and a gift of resilience and strength that encourages even at times myself. She was in the room when Dylann Roof was going through, and she is a survivor. And she did not let him take her voice. She has found her voice of strength, of resilience, and she shares it with others.
Steve Cohen, just did it help?
It did tremendously. I think Polly made quite a number of points to us, but I think the key one for me was the events at the AME Church were 4 years ago. It took her a year just to come to grips with the shooting. It took her another year to begin to realize that she had a voice. It took her 3.5 years to be able to use that voice to start a ministry, to come to do things like coming to Pittsburgh. It was tremendously helpful to hear a survivor who has been able to accept what had occurred. We're nowhere close to that yet. Nowhere at all. There are just too many issues that come up every single day where there's a memory that just touches one and it's like it was yesterday. Mm. The clear anti-Semitism expressed by the shooter is not something that we've ever heard before expressed quite that way in this country. It makes you fearful to walk down the street because of the potential of a person feeling the same way, doing the same thing, simply because you are there.
Steve Cohen, president of the New Light Congregation in Pittsburgh, one of three congregations that worshipped at the Tree of Life Synagogue there. And the Reverend Eric Manning of the Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Reverend.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Mayors from around the country are in Washington, D.C. today through Friday for the annual winter meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And of course, the federal government is shut down. Metaphor? Mayors tend to think they do the nuts and bolts of governing. Steve Benjamin is the Democratic mayor of Columbia, South Carolina, and president of the nonpartisan U.S. Conference of Mayors. And Mayor Benjamin, start with the shutdown because, you know, food pantries get some food from the government, but in the shutdown won't get the thousands of dollars to store it. They're worried about that in Dayton, Ohio. What kinds of things are you hearing about?
Obviously, the real impact, we're dealing with a public housing crisis in our city right now, having to vacate the third oldest public housing facility in the country and not having staff at HUD available to help us with that issue.
Well, let's explain why to people. You get across the country, there is federal rental assistance for low-income housing.
Absolutely. And it's important to note, too, that we say it's federal assistance. The reality is these are repatriated tax dollars. So our citizens send it to D.C. every April 15th, and we like it to come back home in meaningful ways. And something as incredibly damaging as a shutdown has real effects to people on the ground. And obviously, our federal workers who make up a significant amount of our population in Columbia, with the Army's largest training base in the world, they're hurting right now.
Well, remind us of how, again, your city is being affected, some of the concerns. We know Cincinnati, for instance, is worried about maybe having to shut down an addiction recovery center because they won't have the funding they need. What are you looking at?
Our greatest immediate concerns right now is obviously there are some federal grants that support our police department and their work. And we also have a major reconstruction of our levee wall damaged by floods in 2015 that FEMA needs to try and address that. So we're gravely concerned, but we need Washington to work. We need people to work together on pragmatic, principled solutions to the issues facing us. And we hope that we can come to town as a voice of reason this week and get some things done.
You mentioned FEMA. You were hit by both Florence and Michael, the hurricanes.
And Joaquin. Yes, ma'am.
And actually, will there be conversation about climate change and impact on cities? There was a fascinating new poll that shows that a record number of Americans now believe in climate change, 73%. They say it's happening, and they want something done. What are mayors talking about?
No, mayors, we have almost 400 members of our Climate Mayors Caucus, a bipartisan group of mayors who've been aggressively implementing on the local level solutions to try and deal with the issue of global climate change. Our focus at the conference this year, actually a two-year bipartisan agenda, is on infrastructure, innovation, and inclusion. Mayors all across the country are making significant investments in infrastructure, particularly around issues of resiliency and helping mitigate the effects of these storms. But we need a good federal partner and a focus, and it would start with an acknowledgement that climate change is real, and we need the full resources and force of the federal government supporting us in this fight.
And meanwhile, we're reading that Oklahoma has announced they're going to delay bids on transportation projects worth about $137 million, speaking of infrastructure, because they're unsure of federal funding. So the impacts are dribbling down. That's Steve Benjamin, mayor of Columbia, South Carolina, president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting in Washington, D.C. Mr. Mayor, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Robin. You take care.
Thailand may soon be a democracy once again. The country has been under military dictatorship since a coup in 2014, but today Thailand's election commission said there will be a general election on March 24th. Joining us now from Bangkok is the BBC's Jonathan Head. Jonathan, what is the significance of this announcement today?
Well, I think the importance is that we've even got a date. Remember, this is a military regime that seized power in 2014 and promised an election the following year, and then promised one the following year. By my count, there have been at least five postponements to their announcement. We're finally seeing this all-elusive election taking place much later than people thought it would when the military stepped in. They stepped in because they said there was a crisis, there were protests on the streets. And I think, you know, many Thais are anxious to see the country moving on to some kind of political normality. They hope that this election will allow that to happen.
Well, and remind us exactly what that crisis was that caused the military to step in a coup while the prime minister, I believe, was out of the country a few years ago.
Well, we've had two coups in the last 12 years or so, and it's a very prolonged crisis. Essentially, Thailand's politics in the distant past were dominated by military governments or semi-authoritarian governments, but in the year 2001, a new prime minister, Thaksin Shinawat, who was a billionaire, telecoms tycoon, promising a raft of very popular populist policies, came in under a new constitution and won a resounding election victory and won another one 4 years later. But he threatened the dominance of traditional elites in Thailand. There were arguments, though never substantiated, that he threatened the monarchy, which is, of course, very important in Thailand. He was ousted in a coup in 2006, but after that, allied to him, kept winning the elections they held, including his sister Yingluck, who won an election in 2011. We had serious protests against her government. That prompted street clashes. The government lost its authority. It didn't have the military behind it. And finally, we had the military stepping in for a second coup in 2014. And they vowed to reshape the country in a way, they said, to rid it of all its problems. But many people assume, it's pretty thinly disguised, that the real purpose of the military taking over was to make sure that Thaksin Shinawat and his parties, which have won every election for the last 20 years, would not win another one. And that's what we're going to see in this election, because although Mr. Thaksin's in exile, he's got a criminal charge against him, although he says it's politically motivated. His sister Yingluck's also in exile, but his party remains popular, and everyone's wondering whether it will bounce back. But the military has designed a constitution which will make it very difficult for one party to dominate, and we're likely to see the military keeping its sway over Thai politics even once we move into a notionally Democratic era.
What has the military rule been like in Thailand? Probably for many Americans who may have gone there as tourists since 2014, they wouldn't notice anything different. But what has it been like in terms of cracking down on dissent and other things in Thailand?
I would argue it's been, you know, authoritarian light. I mean, the military knew that this is a fairly sophisticated population, highly politicized, that the government they ousted had a lot of popular support, particularly in the countryside, the north and northeast, and among lower income Thais. And they have been very tough on a few dissidents, particularly anyone who said anything against the monarchy. There have been some very harsh sentences. But actually, it's been reasonably easy to be critical, to speak out. I don't think Thais have felt it's a particularly heavy-handed military government, but it has been very conservative, very censorious, and not particularly good at the things it said it would do. It promised to bring harmony and order back, but the country still feels very divided. A lot of people are still very angry about what the military's done. It hasn't tried to win over its opponents, and it hasn't really run the economy particularly well. Thailand's economy is growing, but nothing like as fast as its neighbours. So I think that there's a kind of weariness. I think many Thais feel that they weren't disastrous and they did kind of settle a very conflicted country, but it's time for them to go.
And if the current situation is, as you describe it, authoritarian light, is the next situation likely to be democracy light?
I think that's a very good description. Another political pundit here described it as a hybrid democracy. Mm. What the military has done is they're so determined that Mr. Thaksin, his sister Yingluck and their party won't win, and all the polls say they will do quite well in the election, that they've designed an electoral system which will make it very hard for them to win a majority, as they have done in the past. And they've also allowed for an entirely appointed Senate, an upper house, 250-seat Senate, which the military is appointing. And that will have a lot of say over the government. They're allowing an unelected prime minister to be chosen. I think they're hoping a whole load of smaller parties will be persuaded to back the current prime minister, General Prayut Chan-o-cha, the man who led the coup, to carry on. They really have, you could argue, rigged this election in a way which makes it very likely we'll see a continuation either of some form of semi-military rule, semi-military, semi-democratic rule, or a very weak democratic government that relies on the military. And the military is also put in the constitution that there's a 20-year plan, an economic plan, a reform plan that all governments have to follow, which it has also drafted. So its influence will definitely continue, whoever comes out on top in this election.
That's the BBC's Jonathan Head joining us from Bangkok, Thailand. Jonathan, thank you.
Jeremy, good to talk to you.
Well, many of the world's business and political leaders are gathered this week in Davos, Switzerland, for the World Economic Forum. President Trump did not go, which means he missed an important message from British naturalist Sir David Attenborough, famous for presenting the Planet Earth series. Attenborough is 92, and as he accepted an award for his work on TV, he told the audience that humans better hurry to deal with climate change.
I am, quite literally, from another age. I was born during the Holocene, the name given by scientists to the 12,000-year period of climatic stability that allowed humans to settle, farm, and create civilizations. Those conditions fostered our unique minds, giving rise to international trade in ideas, as well as goods, and making us the globally connected species that we are today.
Attenborough has seen more of the world and its life forms than most of us ever will, from the penguins in Antarctica to the zebras of Africa. But this week, he was in the mountains of Switzerland speaking to another species, very wealthy human beings.
Global businesses, international cooperation, and the striving for ideals, these are all possible because for millennia, on a global scale, nature has been largely predictable and stable. Now, in the space of one human lifetime, indeed, in the space of my lifetime, all that has changed. The Holocene has ended. The Garden of Eden is no more. We have changed the world so much that scientists say that we are now in a new geological age, the Anthropocene, the age of humans. When you think about it, there is perhaps no more unsettling thought. The only conditions modern humans have ever known so far are changing, and changing fast. It's tempting and understandable to ignore the evidence and carry on as usual, or to be filled with gloom and doom. But there is also a vast potential for what we might do. We need to move beyond guilt or blame and get on with the practical tasks in hand.
Attenborough said that climate change is accelerating and that the problem is urgent, but he isn't without hope.
If people can truly understand what is at stake, I believe that they will give permission to business and governments to get on with the practical solutions. And as a species, we are expert problem solvers. But we haven't yet applied ourselves to this problem with the focus that it requires. We can create a world with clean air and water, unlimited energy, and fish stocks that will sustain us well into the future. But to do that, we need a plan.
Sir David Attenborough speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland this week.
You know, coffee breaks, right? You go out and get some fresh air or maybe some fresh ideas at the office coffee pot. Well, that may be a thing of the past. As of yesterday in San Francisco, Starbucks fans can order their coffee through the Uber Eats app and get it delivered for a flat fee of $2.49, a service that's headed to New York, Boston, Chicago, Los Angeles, then beyond. Will you use it? Sam Okas is editorial director of QSR Magazine. They track things fast food. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Robin.
And first of all, there's been a great debate in this office as to whether this is convenience at its finest or the end of civilized society as we know it, with people not going out anymore. But just remind us, I mean, people might be saying, what? Wait, I thought you could order things already. What is advanced or new about this?
Well, what's new about this is Starbucks getting into the game at this scale, and certainly as they roll it out to most of their locations, that's going to be a very a huge endeavor. And the thing about Starbucks doing it as well is, you know, this is, if you have a $4, $5 cup of coffee, you know, that's a little different to order that for delivery than it is for your maybe $12 salad or if you're ordering $25 worth of food for your family.
Right.
So it's a little bit different than other restaurants.
Well, yeah. I mean, are you willing to pay almost half the price of the cup of coffee for the coffee? And apparently people are. Starbucks tested this out in Miami last year. They found it to be very successful. Who's doing this? Do we know?
Well, I'd wager that a lot of millennials are doing this, but it's probably unfair to just stake this on millennials. You know, it's probably most consumers today want more convenience. We're so used to getting anything we want at the touch of a smartphone button, and that's no different than with food. And if we don't have to leave our office to get a lunch or get a cup of coffee, then all the better.
Well, of course, as I pointed out to several young coffee-drinking people in our office meeting this morning, go ahead. You know, you're just turning yourself into a hostage. You know, you're the one that's trapping yourself inside the building. But I want to note, it's not just coffee. Starbucks said 95% of its menu is going to be on the Uber Eats in the coming weeks in one of these big cities. Why would Starbucks do it? Don't you lose something if you don't have someone coming in and noticing, you know, a cookie they also want?
Yeah, you might lose some upselling opportunities. That's true. But at the same time, you gain a whole new potential audience. So anybody who wasn't going to go to Starbucks before because they didn't have the time or maybe it was too far away to get to walk down there, suddenly this is a potential consumer. And so I think it's probably worth it for them. Now, I will say, you know, Starbucks is an experience. You walk in, you get the smell of the coffee and of their food. You know, maybe you don't want to wait in line, but at the same time, coffee shops typically are a matter of the experience you get in that restaurant. And so you lose some of that. that. But at the same time, again, if we can get convenience and we don't have to even move out of our desk chair, then maybe it's worth it.
Well, you also get, you know, folk singers and the latest information. Oh, wait, that's old coffee shops. I mean, you know, there it used to be the coffee shops were a place you went for the communal aspect. So obviously, people using the service aren't interested in that. Also, talk about this flat rate, $2.49. Does that mean that somebody's going to call an Uber? Because $2.49, that's nothing, to maybe drive 10 feet to their office from the Starbucks?
Yeah, I guess it depends. I mean, $2.49, if all you did was order a $5 espresso drink, is $2.49 worth it? And, you know, if you mark up your drink by a third, maybe mm-hmm. it's not necessarily worth it. But if you're ordering for your whole office, maybe you get $50 worth of orders for your floor, suddenly $2.49 seems actually pretty good. But they might actually lose money on the fact that the $50 order is $2.49 is nothing.
Right. And for the consumer, if the Starbucks is across town, that makes sense. If it's right downstairs, I mean, that's just kind of crazy right there. But just talk about this, the whole field of food delivery, Instacart, Grubhub, DoorDash. How is this world being transformed?
Well, it's interesting. So the name of the game today is off-premises. That's the term for the restaurants that are getting into the game of delivery, mobile ordering. You know, if you have takeout with mobile order ahead, it's all kind of under this umbrella of off-premises. And, you know, what this is it's giving all of these restaurant companies, specifically the quick service restaurant companies, the fast food restaurants, an opportunity to get in front of millennials and other very prized consumers. And that's what they're all focused on right now, because suddenly they might be, you know, hip or cool if they can be found on that app that all the millennials are using. So they're focusing a lot of their attention on that. And, you know, the numbers point to the fact that sales are really going up for delivery orders and for mobile order ahead orders. So this is proving to be incredibly lucrative for especially the fast food chains.
Which is why Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley have both valued Uber at the record-breaking $120 billion, in large part because they see upside to these spin-off services like Uber Eats. Where's Uber headed next, do you think?
Uber Eats has an advantage in that all of the logistics behind Uber itself make Uber Eats kind of a sure bet when it comes to the food delivery process, when they have this fleet of drivers already ready to go. But one of the things about delivery right now is there are so many competitors out there, and so it sort of spreads the dollars around. But yeah, I think Uber is banking on the fact that, you know, they are Uber. They have this incredible scale that they can leverage when they are getting Uber Eats out there. And so I think that's something that they're really going to bank on.
Sam Okus, editorial director of the fast food trend magazine QSR. Sam, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
You know, Robin, in Buenos Aires, for years, they walk around and deliver espressos to people's offices in white gloves, by the way. That's what we need.
Well, when someone can bring me my soda, I know it's a terrible habit. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.